All right. Well, as you can see, we have a fun topic ahead of us this morning. This morning, we are talking and looking at one of the many dark spots in the Middle Ages of church history. You may already have some knowledge of the Crusades, some idea of what it was about, or you may know nothing at all about them. But what I want us to see this morning is sort of a mixed bag that the Crusades were. It is certainly dark and appalling in some of the acts of violence done by those doing it in the name of God and in the name of Christ. But even as we've seen over the Middle Ages, though it may not have been emphasized so much as I would like, one of the key components of us looking at church history and this period of church history during the Middle Ages is things were dark. Church was lost in a lot of different areas in politics and theological controversies and did a lot of bad things. But one of the key things about the Middle Ages is that even in the darkest times of church history, God does not leave his people and does not leave the world without a light, without even a spark of the gospel. And so we have that in this period of the Crusades, and I want to show you that this morning. But let's dive into kind of what led up to the Crusades and why they happened. So for the Crusades, what we need to understand is that the Crusades weren't a single battle, they weren't a single mindset, but they took place over the course of just over 100 years. And you had several different Crusades that came and went. Each Crusade lasted about 2 to 3 to 5 years, and then it ended, and then another Crusade came a few years later. But basically what you have in the Crusades is it is a battle between Christians and Muslims over the Holy Land. It's not just one nation against another. It's not one nation fighting for political power over a certain area. The church saw this as a battle for the place where Jesus walked. And what started the Crusades was actually the Byzantine Empire asking the West for help. We've seen already in the past how the East and the West had been divided over theology, and the Byzantines did their own thing, and the Eastern Orthodox Church did their own thing, and the Western kingdoms of France and England and Germany, they did their thing, and the two sides had sort of drawn this dividing line. Each one did its own thing. But in 1094, the Turks, this new leader of the Muslim Empire, had actually attacked the Byzantine Empire in Asia Minor. And in attacking Asia Minor, they actually drove back the Byzantine forces and redrew the kingdom lines. They redrew what belonged to the Byzantines and now engulfed Asia Minor into the Muslim Empire. And so the Byzantine emperor sends to the West and he says, we need help. We need soldiers. We need fighters to go and take back what we've lost. And so the Pope, seizing an opportunity, sees the East in need of his help. And so he comes to their aid. Over the last few centuries leading up to this, it was very common for Christians, at least Christians who could afford it, to make pilgrimages to Jerusalem. What's a pilgrimage? A journey, a trip. And so a pilgrimage is a trip. It's not a vacation. It's a trip with a religious purpose. And so Christians who could afford it would leave their homes in Europe and Byzantine and they would travel to Jerusalem to simply see the place that Jesus walked. At the time, the church put a very high emphasis on relics. That if a saint or someone who had done incredible things for the church had died, their bones, their clothing, their houses became places of spiritual significance. And not just significance, but also spiritual power. The bones of the saints were believed to bring healing if you touched them. They believed that if you could have a relic, if you could have something that belonged even to Jesus. There's a story of even one monastery who claimed that they had a tooth of Jesus. And that tooth brought all kinds of spiritual powers and supernatural miracles. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. But that's what they believed. And so when you look at the Holy Land from this perspective and through this lens of relics and holiness kind of residing where special things happened, Can you imagine a much more important or a much more powerful, much more significant place than the land, the actual dirt that the Son of God walked on? And so that's how the church viewed Jerusalem. And they viewed the Holy Land. And they said, this is a special holy place because our Savior lived here. He walked here. He performed miracles here. He died here. He rose again here. And there was even a church that they built over where they believed Jesus was had been buried. It's called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It was the church of his grave. And so for centuries, as Christians would travel to the Holy Land on these pilgrimages, the Muslims who ruled the land treated the Christians well. They let them come, visit the space, and then leave. And there was no hostilities, no persecution, no nothing. It was just a peaceful exchange of ideas. And then when the Turks take over the Muslim Empire, that changes. Christians who would continue on these pilgrimages would go into Turkish lands and go to Jerusalem. And then when they would return home, they would share stories of attacks and hostilities. How they had all their stuff stolen. How their family members were beaten. How they were chased out of town. And the church was outraged. And so the Pope calls together this council of kings and nobles and knights and aristocrats. And he says, we need to take back the Holy Land. We need to be able to have our people allowed to go there safely and to make these pilgrimages, to walk where Jesus walked. We need this. And the phrase that becomes this mantra and this battle cry even of the Crusades is Deus Vult. God wills it. Thank you. Well done. God wills it. Now what are some problems with this becoming the battle cry of the Crusades?
Man saying what God wills.
Yeah. And not only that, what happens in the Crusades?
A lot of
violence. And when you attach violence and the slaughter of men, women, and children, and you attach Deus Vult to the end of it, what are we saying?
God says
this is okay. Yes. Yes. It becomes very fanatical. All in the name. And at the same time, the church believes they're standing on the right side of things. Because this is God's will. And so when the Byzantine emperor, he asks for help from the West. The Pope brings together this group. They create this battle cry of Deus Vult, and the Crusades start. What's the word crusade? Where's it come from? Any ideas? So it's from a Latin word. Crux. What's that mean? Not temple. Not pinnacle. Cross. And so the Crusades become this mantra where of carrying the cross. I mean, even the Pope and his council where he called all these nobles together to inspire the Crusades. He preaches from the text where Jesus tells his disciples, you must take up your cross and follow me. And so what do we know about the Crusade knights? What did they wear? Crosses. They put it on their armor. They put it on their helmets. They put it on their swords. They put it on their shields. Because what they were doing was they were taking up their cross and they were going to defend the name of Jesus against evil Muslims. They believed that Jesus was a person. They believed that he was a good teacher, even a prophet of God, but not the Son of God. So the strengths. Who were the warriors of the Crusades? The knights. And so the knights break down into kind of three popular, well-known groups of knights. You have the Teutons from Germany, the Knight Templars from England, and the Hospitallers from France. They're called the Hospitallers because they built hospitals wherever they went. And they cared for people, and that's kind of how they became known, as the people, the knights who built hospitals. But the knights are far and above the leaders of the Crusades. These are the soldiers. These are the leaders on the battlefield. These are the ones that you want in a fight. Knights have been around for couple hundred years at this point. They became these sort of land-owning aristocrats that carried a sword with them wherever they went. But as is the case with many warrior classes, the knights were known to be a little rough around the edges, to put it nicely. They were drunk all the time, and they took whatever woman they wanted, and they just did whatever they were violent men. And so a bishop in around the time of the Crusades getting started, a bishop writes a book where he creates a moral and spiritual code for the knights to live by. This is a product of the Cluniac revival, if you remember that from a few weeks ago. But they looked at the knights and all the problems that came with these warriors, and they said, we need to reform this. We need to change. We need warriors for the church who can be admirable and someone that young boys can look up to and imitate. What was the code called? Chivalry. Chivalry comes from the French chivalry, because the knights rode on horses. And so chivalry in French means cavalry. And so the code of chivalry was for the knights. It was a code that created a class of knights that turned the knights away from just being a soldier, away from just being an aristocrat. And now the knight was essentially a priest or a monk with a sword in his hand. He was a spiritual leader as well as a physical leader. And so this code of chivalry taught courage and justice and chastity and sobriety and loyalty and prudence. All the things that we associate with chivalry and knighthood. There was the best of the best. And so that because the knight becomes a spiritual leader as well as a warrior, before every battle in the Crusades, a knight would meet with a priest and confess his sins and take communion before picking up his sword and heading into the battlefield. The papacy would look at these knights fighting crusades and would offer them heavenly rewards for their acts on the battlefield, promising them complete pardon from all the temporal penalties of sin just because they're fighting in the name of Jesus. These became known as indulgences. We'll talk much more about indulgences, especially when we get to the Reformation, because it's the indulgences that creates the big stir at the beginning with Martin Luther and others. But these indulgences grow. They expand rapidly. In the First Crusade, an indulgence was given to a knight who went and fought. By the Second, Third, and Fourth Crusade, the Pope actually promises eternal life to anyone who goes and fights the Turks. You want to be saved? Pick up your sword and go kill a few Muslims. That's how you get into heaven. And then, by the Third Crusade, you could buy an indulgence and get pardon from sin by simply hiring a knight to go fight for you. It becomes scandalous and continues to get worse over the next 500 years. Any questions on the events leading up to the Crusades?
There were actually warriors, friends.
Say that again.
French warriors?
Yes, there were French warriors. One time. Yeah, they created hospitals. So when the Crusades start, when the Turks begin punishing and persecuting Christians who are making these pilgrimages, there's such a big public outcry that everyone wants to fight. And so the first group to make the trip to wage war against the Muslims is actually a group of peasants led by a monk, Peter the Hermit. And Peter the Hermit takes his angry mob of peasants with their pitchforks and plowshares and everything else, and they march all the way down to Asia Minor, and they get massacred. The only one to survive is actually Peter the Hermit, and he escapes and runs for his life. But the first Crusades happen after this group of peasants. You get a group of knights that are led by brothers of kings and relatives of nobles. And they gather in Constantinople in 1096, 1097, and they have a force numbering over 300,000. It's a massive army. They arrive in Asia Minor right at the perfect time. The Turks are now warring amongst themselves, and the Muslim Empire has split off into all these different factions. And so this force of 300,000 begin their trip from Constantinople down to Jerusalem, and they begin taking apart the Turkish factions one by one, just wiping them out. One at a time. But the fight and the journey is long, and it's hard, and it's bitter. By the time they actually make it all the way down to Jerusalem, their 300,000 numbered army has dwindled down to 20,000. They've lost a lot. But these 20,000 are enough. They capture Jerusalem in 1099 after a 6-week siege, and they enter the city and they sack it. They destroy everything. They kill everyone. Doesn't matter if you're Muslim, Jewish, even Christian. If you're in the city of Jerusalem at the time, you're dead. And they take it over. And they establish in this conquest down to all the way to Jerusalem, as they go, they establish these little mini kingdoms. And that we call them the Latin states or the Crusader states. You've got Tripoli and Antioch and Jerusalem, and they sort of just become these little city states. But they're ruled by crusaders. And here's where the problems begin to start with this east-west relationship in the Crusades. The Crusaders are Western. They're Catholic. And they've come to help the Eastern Orthodox Church retake the lands that they've lost. And so in these lands that the Crusaders are marching through, you have firmly established Eastern Orthodox churches already there, but they've been persecuted and attacked. Well, when the Crusaders establish these city-states, they look at the Eastern Orthodox churches and goes, you guys are Catholic now. Get out. And so they persecute and attack, and things get so hostile, even after this first crusade, that you have Eastern Orthodox Christians who actually fight alongside the Muslims to drive out the Crusaders. And it gets bad. But after the first crusade, the West has occupied and has saved Jerusalem. It now belongs back to the church. Then you have the second crusade. And the second crusade is more of the same. The Turks had fought back. They had reconquered some of the land, but not all of it. Jerusalem still belongs to the crusaders. And so the church sends more knights to the battlefield. But the second crusade, the thing that stands out, this is where we see that light shining in the darkness, is because of a man back in Europe who inspired many to go and fight. And his name is Bernard of Clairvaux. Bernard of Clairvaux has a great biography. Highly encourage you to read as much as you can about Bernard. Great, great man. We don't agree with everything he did and said, but he was foundational. As a youth, he struggled to kind of find his place. He was born to a wealthy, noble family and lived a life of luxury. And at 22, he decided to become a monk, to leave his life of luxury behind, and he entered into a monastery that valued and prized simplicity. So this was a monastery that wasn't highly decorated and highly illuminated and all this glory and beauty and splendor of some monasteries. This one was not that. It was simple. Their monks wore simple clothing. Their abbots wore simple dresses. I mean, it was just, everything was minimalistic. And Bernard said, that's what I want. And so he joins this monastery. Eventually, he decides to establish his own monastery and he becomes an abbot. And it's not long before Bernard is known as one of the greatest preachers in all of the Middle Ages. His nickname is the honey-flowing teacher because his sermons were said to drip with the love of Christ. Martin Luther said this about Bernard. In his sermons, Bernard is superior to all the teachers, even to Augustine himself, because he preaches Christ so excellently. When the Protestant reformers begin assaulting and finding and critiquing all the different saints and leaders of the church for the last 500,000 years, the only person that they have nothing bad to say against is Bernard. They have nothing that they can critique because he loves Christ and he preaches Christ. Everywhere he went, people were gripped by Bernard's preaching. It was said that if Bernard was scheduled to preach in a particular town or city, that mothers would hide their sons and wives would hide their husbands in case these men became so gripped by Bernard's preaching that they ran away from home and became monks. Theologically, Bernard was a disciple of Augustine. He preached what we would likely call today mostly a reformed theology when it comes to salvation and grace and free will. He is credited with writing even many popular hymns, some that we still have sung today. Jesus, the very thought of thee. That's credited to Bernard of Clairvaux. O sacred head now wounded. That's Bernard, at least credited to him. Now, one of the areas that we would disagree with Bernard is he popularized the idea of, or the adoration of the Virgin Mary. He didn't go so far as to say that she was perpetually without sin, But he saw Christ as the mediator between the Father and humanity, and Mary as the mediator between humanity and Christ. He wrote in one of his letters, "If you are terrified by the thunders of the Father, go to Jesus. If you are afraid to go to Jesus, run then to Mary." Now, he, again, didn't start, go to the length of venerating Mary like we see Catholics doing today, but Bernard is definitely responsible for starting that road. His reputation as a preacher and writer and founder of monasteries was so widespread that he was in constant demand for advice. I mean, here's a monk who kings would leave their kingdoms, travel hundreds of miles to sit at his feet and say, "Tell me what I should do." He was so popular that when the Pope sees the need for a second crusade, he comes to Bernard and says, "Can you preach a sermon that would inspire people to go fight?" Because he knew that if Bernard said go fight, everyone would go. And he does, easily. But the Second Crusade was a disaster. The Byzantines had not asked for help this time, and so they looked at these Westerners coming in as intruders and invaders. And they said, "We're not helping you. We're not going to stop you, but we're not helping you. We're not providing food. We're not providing aid. We're not providing any of it. You're on your own." And the Crusaders perished in Asia Minor before even making it very far, because they either starved to death, they got sick and died from fever, or the Turkish killed them. It was a failure completely. Questions about the Second Crusade or about Bernard? Then you get the Third Crusade. Third Crusade is by and large the most popular. It's the most well known. If you know anything about the Crusades, it's likely this Third Crusade of which you think of. After the Second Crusade, the Turks find unity again. All the factions kind of come back together under the leadership of a new general, Saladin. Saladin is incredibly wise. He's astute on the battlefield. He's a good soldier. He's a good leader. And the Turks rally around him. And so he takes over Egypt, and his empire now surrounds the city of Jerusalem. And eventually he conquers the city. But he doesn't sack it. There's a big difference between when Saladin enters Jerusalem and when the Crusaders enter Jerusalem. Saladin conquers the city and walks in and says to all the Christians, "You may peacefully go home. We're not going to kill you. We're not going to chase you. Tell us what you need. We'll give you food for the journey, but go home." The Crusaders settled the land, so it's now there. And they've had it for years, so there's families, and they've repopulated. It's their city now. And so Saladin conquers it, and he tells the women, the children, the families, you can't stay here. Go home. But he lets them leave peacefully, even with their weapons. Saladin was a just and he was a wise ruler, and he actually put some of the Crusaders, many of the Crusaders, to shame because he was such a difference. Yes.
Did they leave?
Like they left, and now Jerusalem now belongs back to the Turkish Muslims.
I have become great as I am because I have won the hearts of men through truth and kindness.
I think so, yeah. That sounds right. I mean, he was a great leader. He was someone to be admired, except for the fact that he was Muslim. And so in Christendom, they looked at Saladin as the devil incarnate, because he's the guy who retook Jerusalem. How dare he? And so the West is shocked when Jerusalem falls. The three greatest, they're so shocked, in fact, that when they sound the alarm for the Third Crusade, the leaders of the Crusades are the three biggest kings in Western Christendom. You have King Philip Augustus of France. You have King Frederick Barbarossa, the Holy Roman Emperor, and King Richard I of England. These three men, these three kings, are the ones who pick up their swords and saying, "We're going to Jerusalem, we're taking it back." But things don't go as planned. They get on a boat, and as they get just near Tarsus, towards Asia Minor, Frederick Barbarossa falls off the ship, and he drowns. Holy Roman Emperor is gone. Which leaves now two kings who are now fighting constantly for power and who's in charge. They do eventually lead and conquer the city of Acre, which is just north of Jerusalem, and from there launch their attacks on Jerusalem to take it back. But after the capture of Acre, the French king leaves. Again, French. And so he leaves and goes home, leaving Richard the First to stay there and to lead the troops, because Richard the First is not one to give up. He sees it as a Christian duty to reconquer this land. Anybody know Richard's nickname?
Lionheart.
The Lionheart. So, and this is popularized, if you remember the cartoon version of Robin Hood, where all the characters are animals. This is King Richard is gone fighting the Crusades. The Sheriff of Nottingham is in control in his name. And when the king shows back up, what animal is he? He's a lion. He's King Richard the Lionheart. And Richard, he stayed the longest of the kings. His exploits on the battlefield and in discussing and diplomacy were widely known. Even the Muslims admired Richard. It was said that Muslim mothers would frighten their children into obedience by telling them if they did not do as they were told, Richard the Lionheart was going to come and get them. He was their boogeyman of sorts. Eventually, after years of battling and fighting, Richard and Saladin make a peace treaty. And they come to terms and they come to this agreement that puts an end to the fighting. Saladin gives the city of Acre to the Crusaders, and they actually also give them a little bit of land north of Acre, away from Jerusalem. But Saladin also concedes and says, Christians who want to come and visit Jerusalem in peace will not be persecuted. And so these are terms that Richard accepts. He signs the peace treaty and he returns home to England. Questions on the Third Crusade? All right, the fourth and the worst crusade is the soldiers in this first crusade were exclusively French. There were no English, there were no Belgian, it was exclusively French knights. And they were sent to conquer Egypt from the Muslims. And so as they leave France and they get in their boats and they travel down towards Egypt, they make a stop at Venice. Venice is one of those big city-states that has kind of been self-governed. They pay tribute and allegiance to the kings, but it's kind of their own space. Venetians are their own people. But Venetians have their own little kingdom, and one of their cities in their kingdom, Zara, has decided to split off on their own and pledge allegiance to the Byzantines. And the Venetians didn't like that. And so here you have an army of French knights who are coming on their way to Egypt, and the Venetians say, hey, while you're here, could you help us with a little problem? Could you help us take back Zara? And the French knights, eager and hungry for a fight, say, absolutely no problem. And so they go to Zara and they attack the city, burn the city, kill everyone in the city, and then give it back to Venice as a present. The problem is that the city of Zara was a Catholic city. And so you have French Catholic knights slaughtering Catholic citizens. Not soldiers. The Pope is outraged by this, as he should have been, calls on them to stop, which they don't listen. Again, French. And so the French then leave Zara, and they say, as they're in Zara, after word spreads to Byzantine that this happens, there's a political struggle happening in the Byzantine Empire. The emperor has been deposed and he's been killed and sent into exile. He's died. His son now wants his daddy's throne back because that's mine. You can't take it away from me. And so he hears of these French knights who are willing to sacrifice and kill their own people. And so he sends message. Hey, come help me get my throne back and I will promise and submit the Byzantine Empire back to the Pope. We will leave Eastern Orthodoxy, we will submit to the Pope, and we will reunite all of Christendom again. It's too good of an opportunity to pass up, so the French say yes. And they march to Byzantine against the Pope's wishes. They partner with this emperor, they enter Constantinople, they kill the guy sitting on the throne, replace the deposed son back on the throne and say, good job, now it's time for your pledge of allegiance to the Pope. And the emperor, what does he do? I didn't really mean it. I had my fingers crossed when I said it. Like, there's nothing. He refuses. The French knights don't take too kindly to this. And so they sack the city of Constantinople. And it is, they loot the treasury. They steal gold out of the Hagia Sophia. They burn houses. They kill everyone. I mean, it is destructive. Appalling violence marks the day. It is one of the darkest episodes in Christian history. A crusading army of Christian knights slaughtering fellow Christians simply for material gain, for money, for gold. And though the Byzantines do eventually retake their capital city and things get back to normal, the Byzantine Empire is dealt such a terrible blow that they never actually fully recover from it. And it actually leads to the fall of the Byzantine Empire in the coming generations. Questions on the Crusades? So the Fourth Crusade never actually makes it even to Asia Minor. They don't ever even attempt to go where they set out to go. They get sidetracked because there's money involved. And they killed fellow Christians. So what are the effects? What are the lasting impacts of the Crusades, do you think? What happens as a result? Okay, yeah. Think about the relationship between Christians and Muslims that come as a result of this. There is hatred and hostility for generations because of this. They don't just have bordering kingdoms that are trying to use diplomacy to get along. They hate each other. It is good versus evil, and each side sees themselves as good. What else? Yeah, things split. I mean, the Crusades start with this united effort, Christians versus Muslims, and it ends with Christians killing Christians. You think the schism of 1054 that splits the East and West apart, do you think this helped anything? It only drives that gap even wider. What else? Absolutely. This isn't the state waging war. This is the church waging war. God wills it. These are Christians who are picking up the sword and killing other human beings made in the image of God, all in the name of Deusvolt. God wills it. What else? Yeah. So with this, we know the Reformation's coming. We're 400-ish years away from the Protestant Reformation at this point. And some of the biggest issues that play out in the Reformation get their start here. The first is indulgences. Indulgences become so widespread and so horribly used that the Pope has now usurped and claimed all authority, and he's saying to the church broadly, if you give money to the church, we will pardon your sins. You can literally purchase your own salvation. I mean, indulgences are first granted for some outstanding good deed, like going on a crusade. And that outstanding good deed becomes slowly and periodically broadened to now say that an outstanding good deed that would purchase an indulgence and a forgiveness of sins is simply writing us a check. And then, by the time of the Reformation, indulgences not only cover my sins, but I can also buy indulgences for any of my relatives that are stuck in purgatory. A little bit. But one of the lasting things that plays out in the years leading up to the Crusades is the persecution effect. Here's the first time, or one of the first major times, that the church has picked up the sword to attack and kill those opposed to the church. You disagree with the Pope, you get the sword. You argue with the Pope, you get the sword. If you're a heretic, you get the sword. If you're a Hussite, remember John Huss? Who's John Huss? He's a martyr. Why was he martyred? For disagreeing with the Pope. He's the first, I mean, many trace the beginnings of the Protestant Reformation. We mark it as October 31st when Martin Luther nails the 95 Theses to the church door, and But there are others, many, who actually say this process of Reformation goes all the way back to John Huss, 150 years before Martin Luther, when Huss was killed simply because he disagreed. The Crusades teach the church and show the church that, you know what? This is how we deal with people who don't agree with us. We just kill them. Yeah. And in all of this, one of the overarching themes of the Crusades is the Pope becomes more and more seen as the champion of Christianity. He's the one who called for the Crusades. He's the one who inspired people to go. He's the leader of the church. He's the one who fights for the glory of God and sends his good Christian soldiers out to do his bidding.
Inquisition follows
it. All of that, everything that happens in the Inquisition, the church persecuting its own people happens because in the Crusades the church realized they could. They got a taste for it. Other questions? Man, I got it done before the first bell. All right, that's all I've got. I mean, if you have other questions, I'm happy to talk, but that's what I've got this morning. All right. Thank you, Adam.